Welcome to Speak Freely. Your host for this evening is Jim Fishwick. Jim is an award-winning theatre maker and experience designer who specialises in improvised, interactive and immersive performance.
Kia ora koutou katoa and wamanjika, and welcome to Speak Freely. I'm Jim. I was just introduced by the voiceover. This event is a webinar. We'll be talking improvisation with all sorts of wonderful improvisers over the whole series of events presented by Impro Melbourne. Impro Melbourne is based on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, and we'd like to pay our respects to their elders past and present, and through them to all First Nations people of Australia. Sovereignty was never ceded. I myself am coming to you from Aotearoa, New Zealand, specifically in Kirikiriroa, Hamilton, where tangata whenua are Waikato Tai Nui. We've got a number of guests who are going to be joining the panel this evening to share their wisdom and expertise, and we want to hear from you. What do you want to know from these people? We'll have a couple of questions to ask them, but we want to know, what questions do you have for our panel? You can drop them in the Q&A button in the bottom of your screen there, and we will get to some of those in due course. No question is too big or too small. We will answer them all. Joining me on this adventure is our co-host with the co-most, that got away from me a little, the former artistic director of Impro Melbourne, of Rapid Fire Theatre, of the Dynasty Soap Opera, dubbed by the Canadian press the Queen of Improvisation, and the author of the brand new book, Improvise Freely, it's Paddy Styles. Hello, Paddy, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I like that you get to start with a brief Muppet introduction.
I'm a Muppet!
Lovely to see you, how are you?
I am doing well, I'm very excited about tonight.
Tell her, this was your brainchild. Tell us a little more about the evening.
Well, it's kind of linked to my book, Improvise Freely.
A book, you say?
A book. And the reason I wrote the book was to try to get people to discuss and to talk and maybe look at improvisation from different points of view. In my international travels, I'm starting to feel that improvisation is really becoming an echo chamber. And the rules are reinforcing very linear thinking and very exclusive lines of thought. And it's an art form, and it's a creative art form. And there's room for a lot of opinions. And we need to be curious, and we need to debate and discuss and open up topics so that we all learn and grow. So the panel is to launch from that, to invite people that I've had the great pleasure to meet and work with internationally, and to ask questions and have students and other improvisers ask questions and have a positive discourse, even if we disagree or see something in different ways. Let's be curious about that.
I love it. I can't wait. The book, once again, is Improvise Freely. And it, Paddy, would you like to say a little more about the book itself, or do you want to keep on moving forward?
Well, it's, there you go. Throw away the rule book and unleash your creativity. That's all you need to know. Pick it up if you'd like.
Great. And we'll say a little more about the book at the end. But sprinkled throughout the book, a number of contributions from improvisers from all over the globe, sharing some of their thoughts, responses to the ideas in the book. And I'm very excited to have three of those people with us tonight. Throughout the Speak Freely series, we're going to be visiting different regions of the world. And this week we are in Europe. So our first guest hailing from the United Kingdom is Stephen Davidson. Stephen is the artistic director of the improvised play of Improvable and of Zeal, the Pride Improv Festival. He's also the author of two books about improv, Play Like an Ally and Improvising Gender. Will you please welcome Stephen Davidson?
Hello.
How are you, Stephen?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I am great. Our second guest from Denmark is Steen Harken. Steen is a graduate of the Danish National School of Performing Arts, who's been improvising for over 40 years and is the author of An Improviser's Notebook. Please welcome Steen Harken Hansen.
Well,
hello.
Hello. Hi.
Long, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Excellent.
The sun is shining and I'm happy. Thank you.
Well, it's nighttime here, so I'm jealous. I wish I could have a bit more sunshine.
Sorry.
Give him back. And our final guest from Spain is Fenya Otali. Fenya is the founder of the legendary Status magazine, is the director of Global Impro, and the author of Improv, Dynamics of the Unexpected. Please welcome Fenya Otali.
Hello, how are you?
Lovely to have you, Fenya. Lovely to have
My
you
pleasure.
All here. Like I said, these three wonderful people contributed to Patty's book, Improvise Freely, and we thought it'd be a nice way to kick off the proceedings by getting them to read their individual contributions to the book. Starting with you, please, Stephen, would you like to read your thoughts that you wrote?
Absolutely. Yes and becomes an inclusion issue quickly because different groups of people have a different circle of expectations about what appropriate behavior and material is, and we tend to default to the cultural majority in the room. Something simple like a man and a woman high-fiving will raise alarm bells in some cultures and be completely unremarkable in others. If we assume that everything we're okay with will be yes-anded by our partner and vice versa, it becomes very easy to create a culture of assimilation and or oppression.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Stephen. That's from the chapter where Patty explores yes and that was a lovely contribution. I was very glad to have that. In the book, I should say, I was the editor of the book. I'm not just sort of some random who's like, I am glad that you put that in the book. Well done. We'll move on to Steen. Steen contributed a section, contributed some thoughts to the section on transaction scenes. Steen, would you like to read your contribution, please?
Yeah, I'd love to do that. I never use these rules as rules when it comes to improvisation. I use rules when working in the studio. To me, rules are tools that can be used to both unlearn old habits and to learn new skills. But when improvisers work on stage, these rules do not work. They will prevent the improviser from playing freely and letting their imagination merge with their acting skills and the stories that emerge. That's what I've written at some point. Yeah, but I still go for it. Yeah.
Stand by it. Good. And finally, Fenya also contributed some thoughts about yes. And Fenya, would you like to read your thoughts?
Yes, thank you very much. When I started teaching abroad, I discovered that there was one rule I felt more present, especially in the North American improv circle, the omnipresent yes and. I remember watching my students playing some scenes perfectly adapting to every offer, and it was great. But at a certain point, that yes anding turned into over yes anding. Every single offer was taken, and that made it impossible for the improvisers to focus on one thing. When I told them they should be more careful when making offers and accepting absolutely everything, they look at me like I just blasphemed. We gave it another try, and this time I told them that they should only accept the offers they found interesting. The result was fascinating and very uncomfortable. I could see them struggling with the idea of saying no, but eventually they understood that if they've made fewer offers, and any offer would be interesting for their partner.
Thank you very much. These are some of the exciting thoughts, thought-provoking ideas that you could be reading if you picked up a copy of Improvise Freely. Before we carry on, was there anything that anyone said there that people wanted to chat about, respond to, build on, disagree with?
If I could just ask, It was really amazing to me that in writing the book, when I reached out to improvisers and said, "Hey, look, there's a book about the rules, and I'm seeing some problems in the rules. What do you think?" I didn't have anybody come back and say, "No, the rules are good," which really amazed me. Now, there was different points of view on how to use rules or what type of rules or what we're talking about with rules, but no one came back and said, "Yes, keep the almighty rules." So from your experience, Steen, Finian, Stephen, what are you seeing in the rules culture of improvisation? And do you feel it's affecting the work in particular on stage?
I think rules help. They do. But at a certain point, you need to rules per se work, because people just don't question rules. They go and they follow what you want and so on. But at a certain point, the actual learning is questioning those rules. So if I rather convince the people that, hey, try this, not because it's a rule, because I need you to believe in this tool, suggestion or whatever, than just saying yes to it. So it's easier to give rules instead of explaining why they would help you. We live in a world that's based on rules. From the justice system in every corner of the world is follow these rules. Don't question, don't ask too many questions, just follow this, because it's easier to have more people agreeing to something.
I like to say in my, can you hear me? Yeah. In my teaching, I never use the word rules. I talk about suggestions. I say, maybe we should try to do it this way. To my experience, this could work, maybe. So I suggest something to people because I, as a, me personally, I have always been, even as a child, I didn't like rules. I like to pardon my French, to fuck up with them, because I didn't like them, because my creativity was limited in a way I didn't like. So I never made a decision not to talk about rules, but it just came natural to me that, no, this is a suggestion. Maybe you should try this. And also I tried to get into the imagination of the people I'm working with, the process they are in, try to understand what they're doing, to help them. Because for me, some rules might be helpful for some person in that moment, but maybe the rest of the group will think, what is this about? You understand? So it's I try to be very much alive. I come into the room with all the experience I have and had really prepared, but I don't know how things will go, because I don't know who I'm going to meet and how to talk to them, how to explain this. I could talk about this for hours, and Keith has asked me to write a book, but I can't write a book. So I don't use the word, my point is, I don't use the word rules at all. And it's not I've not decided that. It's just my nature. So that's I would like to say that. Yeah.
Finished. Stephen, I saw you had your hand up there.
Yeah. I feel like one of the problems of rules is that they're just so alluring, particularly if you're new to improv, because it's this big, vast unknown and you want something firm to anchor yourself to. So even things like a structure, like the alphabet game, you explain it to a beginner and they're like, yes, I know the alphabet, I can do this. But I think what we're seeing now in the sort of last 5-10 years, especially as we talk more about rules and pedagogy generally, globally, is just better understanding of why we're teaching these games, why we're teaching these rules. And I think we're seeing teachers more and more explain the why and the skill behind things. And I think that is a really positive development. For so many years, improv was just a list of games you learned, right? Because nobody had that context. And I feel like this is a really good thing that's happening now.
Great.
Awesome. I might jump in there with a question that I've been sort of mulling over a lot, but I would love to hear everyone's thoughts on is, so we've got sort of a rules-based impro or a non-rules-based impro. We've got impro or improv. We've got short form or long form. We've got comedy or theatre. There's lots of different divides in improvisation in a lot of way that we seek to sort of classify this and this. Are these kinds of divides helpful? Are there ones that you use yourselves besides some of the ones that I've mentioned here? Again, maybe this is sort of leaning towards trying to find rules and absolutes by trying to like nail everything down to either being this or that. Yeah, there's not a firm question on the end there, but do you find these kinds of divides to sort of classify different kinds of improvisation useful? Are there ones that you use? Any thoughts?
I reject the term divides. I feel like this, all of these words, they're vocabulary for us to understand what's going on. And I feel like most of us who've been improvising for a while have sort of touched on lots of different styles and forms and formats, right? So those words to me are the most efficient way to get a group of different people into one room and all be doing the same thing, which I think is fine as long as we've contextualized that.
Yeah, I would agree that if we're using the words just for clarity, right? This rehearsal is going to be a long form or a short form. But even that, the definition of long form and short form really is fluid depending on, you know, the culture of the improvisation and the company that you're working with. But when it becomes descriptive terms to create divide, oh, I don't do short form anymore, I've advanced to long form. You go, well, if you enjoy long form, I'm happy for you. Why do you need to be critical of short form? They can both exist. Same with the, you know, the comedy or theater. I mean, comedy is theater, and theater is comedy and tragedy, and you know, it all exists. So if we're using it to be clear, this is a pub prop show and our aim is to make people laugh, therefore I'm terming it comedy, then it's a title. But if it becomes a divide, I do this and it is better and therefore excludes everything else, that's not helpful.
I don't believe in formats as such. I believe in creativity and I love theater. When I don't do much shows, but I teach a lot. And I tell people, find people who are interested in doing the kind of theater you want to do and find ways how to do that. You can look at what other people are doing, be inspired, that's cool. And for me, if I start a scene with any of you, in the very first moment, there will be sort of a kernel in which there's a demand or it will be asking for comedy, tragedy, humor, a musical or whatever. And you should train yourself in listening to that thing there, because it's there. And then you should develop that instead of saying, today we have to do everything funny. Maybe something is happening between Finne and me in when we start an improvisation that's absolutely not funny. And then I would sort of put limits on my creativity, or I would sort of put a straitjacket on it. Or instead of just, what is there? What is there? What is need to be told? And how is it this thing asking for to be told? That's I don't divide things because I don't understand division. I don't get it. There's an interesting man who has written about what happened when an anthropologist, they went out in the world and how to ask the people out there, what is this, what is that, you know, and he wanted to divide things into systems, but they talked about what is this useful for. And I think that it could be the same thing when you're starting a scene. You should not put it into a system. You can use a system, but you should, what is living there and what could it bring? I'm talking too much. I'm sorry. I'll stop here.
I think for me, I will go earlier in the discussion with the idea of what do we teach? And eventually, what do we do? But what do we teach is, do we teach the ability to improvise? Then you can use it for anything you want, for business, for writing, for dancing, for running. But at a certain point, you make a choice that, okay, I'm an actor, I do theater, and this kind of theater, with the particularity that it's improvised. That's how I work. I do the kind of theater I would do scripted, but improvising because it's better for me. It's more fun for me, and that's also what I like teaching. So the first moment in which we start teaching the ability, the skill, then are the students that are at a certain point going to decide what they're going to do with that. I think our job is to tell them all the different applications that you can find. So it's short form, long form comedy, drama, musical, dancing, painting, or whatever. It depends on your skills. I will teach theater because that's my skill. I won't teach improvising songs because I'm not a musician. So what's the ability, the skill itself, and the application to the art form? I think that's and then you do whatever you want with it.
All right. We might move on. Patty, I know that you had a question prepared.
I do. So I was doing a little bit of reading because all of our guests have written books, blogs, the Status magazine. So I was going and looking at that for a prompt. So Fenya, could I ask you to read the quote from the latest Status magazine, which is number 123, and happy 10-year anniversary to Status magazine.
Thank you very much.
Yay! And that's something a lot of Australians may not know about the Status magazine. It's a great impro resource, so please check it out. It's a wonderful resource. And this comes from your opinion piece, which is called This Is Our Job. So could you read that, please?
Yes, sure. This is out of the oven, just the latest issue. So I didn't have time to contradict myself yet. So this is our job. This is a part from the article. It says, next time you ask for a discount or a scholarship, think about the professional behind that request. Make no mistake, if we can afford to give that discount or scholarship, we will. But keep in mind that is our salary, that we need that income, that most of us are independent artists and there's no huge company behind us. Would you ask the butcher for a discount? Would you tell your dentist to treat you for free? Would you demand the supermarket to give you free groceries? No, right? That's what it means to be professional. This is our job.
Thank you. And Stephen, if I could ask you to read from your blog, this is an excerpt from a blog post called Community Improv, and it was written in April of 2021.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's a long one. All right. When I hear the term professional improv, the people using this term are often very keen to categorize themselves as professionals. When they're people who've had the opportunity to go to drama school, who are seemingly eager to pull up the ladder behind them, or folks who have been doing improv long enough to be tired of watching aggressive jams and lackluster heralds, there's an importance placed on the identity of professional and the separation of the lesser community folk. Here's the thing that's tripping me up, though. Improv is collaborative. It's inherently community-based. As an expression of all the people doing it, it's one of the most egalitarian of the art forms. The words that we use to describe ourselves as improvisers, as well as others, have a huge impact on perception. By labeling one improviser a professional improviser and another a community improviser, we're creating a ceiling that the community improviser now has to break through in order to achieve success. But there are rarely, if ever, big break moments in improv. Careers build gradually, adds to skill sets. If we're chasing an imaginary ceiling, never quite feeling like we've broken through it, we're setting ourselves up to feel inadequate. And we're helping to construct a community full of people who have nagging self-doubt, are eager to chase the idea of professionalism to assuage that self-doubt, and are doomed to failure, and not to mention ripe for exploitation.
Thank you. I love both of these excerpts because I completely agree with both points of view. And yet both points of view are looking at the word professional, and do we use that word professional? And I consider myself a professional. And I consider myself a professional because improvisation is my job. This is my career. This is what I do. And it has a different place in my life than a hobby like gardening. Gardening doesn't pay my bills. And so when I use the term professional, it's basically to say, yeah, this is my career and I invest in this and this is how I earn my living. And I'd like people to understand that and respect that, that there is a difference between career and hobby. But I hate using the word professional as a status or a privilege club card, which can limit or create a division, even if it's mentally in students. Professional doesn't always mean that someone's more skilled or they're not as good as someone who's community. But the word professional means something to me. So I put this to the panel. Can we honestly acknowledge that a career and a creative outlet are different pursuits? For example, would you classify a professional ballet dancer and someone taking ballet classes on the same level? Can we value and respect that these different levels of skills and experience and provide opportunities and creative challenges for growth and development for all? Can we have a difference in skills and not a division in collaboration? Over to you.
I would love to think that we can, but I know that a lot of us who are able to be professional improvisers come from a position of privilege, and that's part of why we can afford to be professional improvisers, especially in that first like couple of years before your Patty Styles.
There's more of me?
I mean, there were five of us when we signed in. and I feel like it's important to acknowledge that the financial privilege of being able to do it professionally doesn't necessarily mean that you're a better performer than someone who has a day job. And I worry about the way that we use those words and the value system that it could set up.
For me, being a professional is connected that everything I do is connected with theater, with improvisation in particular, and that all my time, all my professional time is dedicated to that. So for me, being a professional is more about commitment than income. What I add is that if I'm rich or if I have a very great paying job and the rest of my time I do it for improv, then of course I could invest money in being a better improviser, in taking more classes, in traveling the world, in whatever. The fact that I depend economically from my job is the Damocles sword hanging from a thread in your head. Is that I need this. It makes me work and use all my time to commit to that art form, and I don't have any other distractions. That for me is being a professional, and it's not connected again to the quality or to the level or if I'm a better improviser than an amateur. And the other side of that equation is the being an amateur. It's beautiful because the root of the world is to love that thing that you do. You do it out of love. You don't need to have a financial income or retribution for that. So for me, the idea will be to commit as a professional and to love it as an amateur.
Mm.
If people ask me what I'm doing, I'll say I'm a performer in some way or another, because I'm performing in my life, which means I'm doing something to give people something. And I never, professional. I understand that there are some people who really like to become professional because in some sense they feel that it's sort of a stamp that they are good enough so they can make money from it. And if people talk like that, I say, then you have to learn how to do your trade. I mean, you have to learn how to do it. I was trained in electrician before I became a performer. And I knew that if I wanted to do my job, I should know how to do it, so people would pay me money for what I'm doing. And in my world, professional is that you can live from it. I mean, it's all. And I mean, it's not a question of quality at all, not at all. I met some people who was doing completely different stuff, and they were amazing when they were sort of getting rid of all their defenses and they just let their creativity work on stage. That was amazing. So I'm sorry, I cannot really give something to this because it's sort of a question I don't really meet. But when I meet it with, I teach at schools, theater schools, where people, it's sort of pre the official national theater school here in Denmark. And they are very ambitious because they believe that when they finally get into the theater school, they'll become professionals and they will have a, but the thing is that around 30% of the students who will become professionals, who can live from it, and the rest of them will be educated actors that are out of work. And I mean, I feel sorry for the people who have to, it's not to be arrogant, but I feel sorry for the people who have to suffer from this sort of struggle within themselves. Amateurs mean that you put a lot of amour, love, into the work. And I think we should really, that's what I'm trying to do. It is to help people really to feel love for what they're doing by trying to free their creativity and feel the joy of that. And be that what, if they are, I worked with professionals, some of them are assholes and they don't want to learn anything. And I mean, and they don't really want to be creative. They just want to be more, fuck that, never mind. So I hope I could contribute with just a little bit of all these words. So that's all.
I think there's something that, for me, the amateur situation is something in the middle between the hobby and the profession. And that's, for me, is the problem or the difficulty of classifying it. Because like Patty said, she likes gardening. I like playing football. I wouldn't dare to call myself an amateur football player. These are other people that work in minor leagues or play for free or with making little money. And of course, it's far from being a professional football player. So I think the issue is when you're an amateur. And again, is do you call yourself an amateur? Or do you, for instance, if you do a show and you know you're an amateur, you consider yourself proudly an amateur, would you say, hey, this is an amateur show? Would you do it for free? Would you charge less for your show? Do you make that difference with the professional show or the rest? Or do you consider yourself a professional for the moment you go on stage and charge a ticket? That's the question.
I have, I turned this there. You can see there sort of this thing there. So I am playing the bass, not this watch, but some electric bass in a Christmas show that I do every Christmas with some good friends. I do that professionally, but I'm not a musician because I don't play very well. So I'm sort of in this dilemma. I'm an actor pretending to be able, I'm playing all right, and I'm still taking classes to learn how to become. I had a class yesterday with a professional musician. So I find also myself in this dilemma in some sense, that I'm in a professional show, people are paying money to see what we are doing, and I'm pretending to be a musician. I mean, it's...
Yeah, but sorry that I interrupt again, but in music, it's very clear. It's, you can play an instrument and you can be very good to play an instrument. That doesn't mean you're a professional musician.
No.
So you can learn to play the bass and you can do okay, or you can do great for this show in particular, or learn these songs. That doesn't mean you're a musician. You can compose, you can create music.
And
for instance, you say you were taking classes.
Yeah.
And for me, it depends on the goal. Do you want to, you're taking classes to become a professional musician, or you're taking classes because you want to play your instrument better or because you like it? That's, you can take cooking classes and not expecting to become a professional chef. That's what I mean.
Stephen, I saw you had your hand up there.
This is an interesting turn for the conversation to go. I used to be a classical musician professionally. Went to school, did all of the works. And the only time now I would want to refer to myself as a professional musician or mention that I had been a professional musician, I think, is if somebody was treating me like an amateur musician. So for me, there's that emotional weight behind the words. And I wonder what that's bringing to our discussion about that. Are we professional because we're better than amateurs? And as long as the answer is no, I am fine with the word.
Yeah, absolutely. That was sort of what I was thinking about, the way that if we say something is amateur or amateurish, it's an insult. If we say something's professional, it's a compliment. Because we have this attachment of, oh, if you do it for money, it must be good. If you don't do it for money, it must be bad, which also connects to the way that sort of anything that you do for fun at the moment, there is sort of an expectation that you're going to get better at it so you can then do it for money. That if you pick up any hobby, then eventually the expectation is that it's going to become a side hustle.
You don't have to monetize everything. It's like, yeah. Say, you should put a restaurant. No, I like cooking for me, my wife, and my family. That's it.
Exactly. We're going to move on now to audience questions. Sorry, I could keep talking about this all day. Our first question is from Catherine Weaver. And Catherine's question is, do you have a personal artistic vision for your work? To sort of expand on that, like, what are the terms in which you define your artistic goals? What are you trying to work on? Just, you know, a very small question to start with. Thank you, Catherine.
I would like to say that... my goal, because I'm teaching, I have two things. I'm teaching and I have a dream about a theater. But when I'm teaching, I'm trying to help people to be able to realize their dreams with a current theater, a current way of telling stories from the stage. And that is sort of my artistic goal, in the sense that I have to be very creative in the way I'm working with people to make them have possibilities to realize their dreams. So that is sort of, in that aspect, my artistic dream. According to a theater, I would love to have a theater here in Copenhagen where everybody in the house was trained improvisers, and they was very much, in French you say, au courant, that they would know how to show things on stage today. I would love to have that, but since the Minister of Culture in Denmark don't support anything that has the word improvisation in it, I don't have a chance to do it because I don't have the means. So that was from me, Copenhagen.
For me, sorry, yes, Steve, Go.
Go on.
Your spotlight.
Am I? Oh, I can't see the spotlights. I really struggle to categorize stuff like that really efficiently for myself because I play and teach lots of different styles and have other stuff on my plate like inclusion and trauma-informed practice and voice work, etc. But I think if there's something that unites them that I'm sort of selling, it's communication and emotional literacy. And I feel like that just expresses itself in different ways on different days.
For me, in the general level, is my goal is to make people feel things when I do theater, when I play anything. If they feel they're not in the real world, that's more than enough for me, and it's very hard to achieve that. And on the formal way, it depends on. Right now, I'm working a lot on the subtext and symbolism and how to avoid being too literal. That for me, improvisation in general is extremely literal and real, and I like to take it to a deeper world, a more symbolic, a dreamy world, both in the words and in the images that we present.
I think for me, I felt when I first started improvising, there was this amazing learning curve. And not just the improvisation skills, but it was the learning the skills, the learning how to create, the experience of creating, the self-reflection of myself as I was going through this experience. And I think I'm at a place where I'm trying to find that next level of growth and development. Not next level that it's above any level, but like the next chapter for me, what else can be created? How can I create experiences more deeply, more fully, more artistically? What stories haven't I told that I would like to tell? I've got a burning curiosity building, and I'm not quite sure where that's focused yet. So look out. but I'm feeling this hunger for that.
Something that I've been working on a lot at the moment is this ongoing metaphor of when I started improvising, I was doing theatre sports in Sydney, which is like this sort of, and I got really good at it, I think, and I was just doing this. And then, you know, I went to Chicago and I learned, oh, there's this other style of thing as well. And then around Australia, all these other things. Then I was doing immersive work and interactive work, and it's sort of, and what I want to do really is to sort of see if I can find the whole circle. Like what are all the different things that improvisation can be? We've got a quick follow-up question from Sandy Morrison for Stephen. Stephen, I know this is probably a very big topic, but would you mind telling us a little bit more about trauma-informed practice in improv? Maybe just a quick introduction to what that is.
Oh gosh. So I think being aware of what trauma is and what it looks like and how it functions is a big missing puzzle piece in particularly in inclusion. So when we see people have fight, flight, freeze, or appease responses on stage or in an exercise, understanding what that is and why it might have happened and knowing how to effectively debrief or de-escalate that. I think especially if we're doing work that purposefully includes difficult subject matter, and or if we're doing beginners classes where people's therapists have sent them to practice their social skills or work on anxiety, which just happens so often, I feel like just a little bit more vocabulary around how to effectively handle that is really useful. And I think a lot of trauma is tied to identity as well. So if we look at including BIPOC folk, women, LGBTQ people, folks with disabilities, etc., the layers of how collective trauma affects those people and how obliging them to share stories might also be quite triggering is important to consider when we're dealing with different groups, especially if we're not members of those groups.
Mm. Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Stephen, if I could ask, because we have the same experience in Australia, and it's also been a similar in Canada, that therapists and counselors, you know, trying to help individuals to develop their social skills or, you know, whatever area of growth they're working on, they recommend an improvisation class. And of course, other people in the class don't know that person's journey, and the teacher in the class may or may not know the journey, and the teacher in the class is not a therapist. So do you think there's any value in having different types of beginner classes? So one is like a beginner, you're heading to the stage and it has a different focus. Mm-hmm. And one is a beginner class, which is come and experience and play. This is social. So right at the beginning level, people can choose, oh, I want a social outing. That's doing improvisation. You know, like here we've got bushwalking clubs that you know, just go walk in the bush with a group of people, right? And then we've got others that are like, no, this is going to be a little bit more focused on the work, because it is a weird place to put the teacher in to go, oh, I see something's happening, but I don't know you. And do I have the right to ask you? And in asking, that could be triggering. But I've got 19 other people in the class that I need to run through this exercise. So, yeah.
Yeah. If there's the audience for those two classes to be separate, I mean, it would certainly make life easier. But I feel like not every improv scene has so many students that they can run these courses parallel. Mm-hmm. If the resources permit, having two teachers for a class, especially if there's 20 people, is a really nice way to manage that, because then one person can go talk to that extra person who needs that attention, and the other one can sort of hold the room. I think broadly just setting up really clear expectations and specifying what the boundaries are of the space could go a long way towards that as well. And just remembering that even if the class is going towards a performance, that might not be why someone has signed up for it. And for them, maybe success is going on once in a set, and that's their bar. They're just like, yep, I went on stage, I did it, that's it. And that's cool too.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I've got two questions here on a similar topic, so I'm going to smush them together and to make one question. So Jessica Liu asks, how do you find the motivation to be creative during these weird times? And Christoph Gregory asks, looking outside of the theatre and improvisation, what feeds and informs your work? So maybe think of it in terms of like, what do you need coming from the outside to feed and nourish you? And then what do you draw on from inside you to be able to process that and create work? Mm-hmm. Small questions from our audience, everyone.
For me, it's reality. Whatever happens in my innermost closest circle to the outer, what's happening in the other side of the world or the world in general, that's the what inspires me, and how I transform it, or the form I use to do that is everything I consume of art. Every movie, every book, every play, I go twice a month at least to the theater. I'm always with a book around. My wife, it's all about theater, so I have theater all over my house, and she specializes in Federico García Lorca. So everything around Lorca is now crossing everything I do because it's there. So I think a good thing that we have as improvisers is that we can feed out of everything and then channelize it however we want to.
Well, I think there's a story in anything I meet, in everything I just is confronted with, or I confront myself with. And I try to train myself to look at the things in from this very different perspectives. How would a doctor look at this? How would somebody else look at this? And then I try to combine it with some thoughts like, is this unjust? Is this unfair to somebody? Is this completely stupid? So to have a point of view on this thing. So I sort of train myself to look at, and made a small blog about that. I mean, I train myself every day to look at things and to look at them from different perspectives. Mm-hmm. So I train myself to have many, many, many ways of looking at stuff. And then I'm trying to mix it a little bit, just for 2-3 minutes every day with attitude. I mean, why are they treating the cows in Denmark like that? How would I look at it? You understand what I'm saying? So I'm trying to be creative in that sense, combining different things in odd ways and trying to find how can I make it that into something. I don't know if that answered any of this, but I tried. Yeah, I'm so lucky I can do it because that's what I'm doing. I've been doing it for so many years, so it's sort of part of my nature now. And have fun every day. Yeah, look at things in different ways. I mean, yeah.
This is more of a hot take than a helpful answer, but I feel like if you're not excited to improvise, take a break. If you don't want to be there, I don't want to watch you. Go for a walk, it'll be fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I add to that? And if you're there just to have fun for yourself and not fun for the audience, fucking get off stage, go home, go somewhere else. I mean, get off. I mean,
yeah. If it's a student show, that's different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Because it is about the students having an experience of being a student. Yeah. Right. It's about the class. It's about the joy of the class, the success, the experience, you know, getting on stage is success in itself, whatever happens in the work. But if you have a paying audience, you know, they're not paying to watch you have a good time. They've come to have a good time.
Yeah.
Right. It's like standing outside of a restaurant and watching someone have a really good meal and you're paying the bill. It's like, why? I agree with you, Stephen. You know, if improvisation is feeling it's not lighting you up, then take a break, you know, and find ways to stimulate your imagination.
Yeah.
And it's completely normal to go through ebbs and flows of being totally in love with the form and then wondering why you ever bothered to go to the first class. It's very much a relationship. You know, and that's okay. For me, if I'm feeling tired or fatigued, or I'm feeling that improvisation doesn't bring that pleasure, I try to put experiences in front of me that are different. I try to kind of just shift. So pick up a piece of music I've never heard, a book or a poem by someone I don't know, go to a gallery I've never been to, just try to have some new influx of something. Because even in that new, I find that that wakes me up. And it's not that I'm bored of improvisation, it's I was just bored. And I need something to chew on so that I have something to bring to the work. And once I have that little spark, then I'm back.
I would like to add just a little bit. As a student at the theater school here in Copenhagen, we had a teacher called Brian Way, and he said, I'm sure that you will go the same way to school every day. I'll ask you for the next 2 weeks to see at least 5 things on the way you have never seen before. I still do that now, more than 40 years after. I try to look at known things and see details I'd never seen before. And it has been very helpful.
Wonderful. I'm going to move on to another couple of questions that return to our original theme around rules and creativity. So one of them is from Hazel Salmonen, who says, sometimes I think restrictions actually feed creativity. How would you see this relates to the discussion on rules and improvisation? When we have a rule, we have to be creative working around it. And also it could feel stifling. What, in your experience, happens to creativity when restrictions are removed? So I suppose there's two questions there. One is sort of many authors will say that sort of the most intimidating thing is just a blank page, and they know they have to write something, but there's what are they going to do? And then the second half of it is what happens to people who have had restrictions, and then those restrictions are taken away from them. In your experience, anyone would like to jump in?
Mm-hmm. I'll just kick off to kind of frame it a little bit with the book. The rules that I'm talking about in the book are rules that are dictating creativity. So there are rules for exercises, you know, as Stephen said earlier about the alphabet game. And sometimes those restrictions do help creativity, but that rule, or, you know, just the explanation of how to play it, so you don't have to call it a rule. Like Steen was saying, you can find a different way. Let's try this. We're going to use the alphabet. It's going to start each sentence. So we don't have to call it a rule. It's still a restriction. And that restriction does challenge our brain to process information differently. The rules that I'm looking at in the book are the rules that are trying to dictate how we create. So never ask question. That's removing so much possibility from the work, right? That it becomes a restriction that dominates everything instead of a restriction for a scene, an activity, a night. So the book is looking at those bigger restrictions that are stopping our ability to create freely, not the restrictions of an exercise or a game. But I'd like to hear what the everybody else has to say to Hazel's answer.
I have a problem with dogmas. That rule that you don't, you're not supposed to question. And once Donna Juliana, also an amazing improviser from Romania, living in Belgium, and to make it short, I'm a questioner. Inside these four tendencies, I'm a questioner. I would follow rules if you explain them to me, give me a perfectly logical reason, and I accept it. If I like it, understand it, I will use it. But the idea of, no, just because, you already have me in the other team. Why? Because it's maybe, and most probably, it's because you don't have a way to answer to that why. So you don't ask questions. Why? I don't know, just because... If you give me a perfectly logical reason for me to not ask questions and I buy it, I will follow that rule because I make it mine. I make it my restriction. I make it my decision. But if it's just don't ask why, just trust me, earn my trust.
I like to, for instance, challenge my creativity by saying, okay, we have this blank piece of paper. I want to make a forest only drawing triangles. Then I would really challenge my creativity in a way I've never done before. So that in that sense, it could be challenging to my creativity because I have to learn a new skill and a new way of expression in some way. What I do when I teach, if I see somebody struggle with something and I have, we have, when we are trying to do status or whatever kind of skills we are training, then I never thought of it as rules, but I will come up with suggestions that they limit this don't try to do this, but try more to do this. So I invent, let's call it rules, that for that particular moment, it will help that person or these persons on stage to find their way to move the story forward or develop the character or whatever is needed. So they will have, people are different, so they have to experience the same thing in different ways. And it's my job to find ways to feed, you understand what I'm saying. So I think that if I just apply rules for the rules, I mean, when I was a child, I fucked that up all the time. Doing Scrabble, people hated playing with me because I said, but that's another word. It means a special way for a cow to chew the grass. And I said, if I can make you believe that, why don't I have a lot of points? And I mean, that's my attitude to rules.
I really love the differentiation you made between here is the rule for right now and here is the rule for always. Because I think that's part of the issue with the improv rules is the idea that you can never ask questions is difficult. But what if we're playing questions only and you can only ask questions in this game, right? Like there's always going to be a loophole to that rule. Or what if it's, a simple thing like in this rehearsal, we're not having any physical contact. Doesn't mean you're not allowed that anywhere in improv. That's just what works right here for this specific thing. Or maybe nothing but triangles. I think the problem comes when we try to take a rule from one situation and apply it to another without then thinking about the why.
Absolutely. And I think the language of rules leads students to do that. Because if you say the rule is that you always have to draw trees with triangles, then when that student becomes a teacher, they're going to go, every time we draw a tree, we have to use triangles. So a helpful restriction in a particular exercise on a day for a student has now become a domination rule for everybody always. And this is the language rules lead students to go, oh, it's a rule. It goes into a category in my brain. If you said, we're going to try this, or for this exercise, we're going to add this restriction, or for this exercise, here's how we play it, then we're not locking people into going, this is an absolute forever, I must. So there's that connection to the word rules as well as how we're using rules. So then you get things like, you always have to name each other. Well, then you can't do scenes with strangers. Right? Now, names and scenes are useful, but so are scenes with strangers. So when it becomes something that conditions our work and restricts the possibility in any other way, that's not a restriction of creativity. That's a restriction that stops creativity.
I think also it's a bit like if somebody is lost in Paris and I hand them a map of Copenhagen and say, okay, use this to find your way. It's kind of stupid. But on the other level, if they realize that Paris is also streets and roads, and you can learn from looking at a map that is from Copenhagen, then maybe it could help you to find your way in Paris. Maybe that's a stupid image, but that's what I'm thinking.
I think there's something also very, very specific about the vocabulary and the adaptation of the vocabulary, and where did these rules were born, and how, for instance, the Spanish-speaking word translated them. I never heard of yes and. That didn't exist in my formation. That doesn't exist in the Spanish-speaking world. We use acceptance. And I think it's a broader concept than just yes ending. Yes, we use the sí y además, something similar like that. But the word aceptación is basically to accept that. And for me, yes ending, or the acceptance of saying yes to everything, is the most misunderstood rule concept in improv. Because maybe at the beginning, you don't quite get it. And not because it's the teacher's fault, but because it's a concept that you get to understand with time. So if you take a couple of classes, you take 1 year, and you don't quite fully grasp the concept of acceptance, of yes ending, then you keep in your head, oh, yes, it's about saying yes to everything. And that spreads all over. So if I take one class and then I tell my friends that are not connected to improv, they're not going to teach, I'm not going to become the teacher, just saying, hey, there's this form in which you say yes to everything, it's great. These people take for granted that that's improv, saying yes to everything. And the worst case scenario is that person that took 1 year, never understood the whole concept of acceptance, of yes ending, starts teaching that it's all about saying yes and no, and asking no questions. That's, for me, the problem. Is it's easy it's easy to get, but not to understand. You get the idea, but you don't fully understand it. So you misteach. I don't know if that exists, but you misteach the concept, and that replicates much faster than good teaching.
Yeah,
absolutely. And this sort of ties into one of the other questions here from Dane McFarlane. Who asks, if it's all improvised, why does it often look the same? Which is quite cheekily the title of an article by Michael Such that I've dropped in the chat there. But I think Dane's question, sort of in this context, speaks to people, again, sort of like, as I was saying before, like having a very narrow scope of what improvisation can be and what it should look like, and they're seeking to replicate what they have already seen, replicate the thing that's been generated by the rules, that improvisation has become this procedure or this formula that has created sort of a formulaic work in a way, in when sort of strictly rules have been applied. I'm going to steer from that to a question from Kath Ryan about rules, which is, as teachers, how would you work with a group that has traveled down a linear thinking rules approach where exclusion and oppression was apparent? How do you steer them back towards a collaborative practice away from that linear thinking rules approach? What can we do in the classroom, in the workshop room, with groups that are working in this quite strict rules-based mindset? I mean, Patty, you could probably write a book about this.
I could. Does anybody want to launch in, or should I start?
No.
The first thing, I think, is to understand what level of conditioning they've had. So if they've been playing for 5 years and their whole identity and comfort zone is deeply ingrained in the rules, to suddenly break those rules could cause a lot of angst and fear and anxiety that's not going to be helpful. If they're 6 months in, they're still figuring it out. So even though they've heard the rules, they're still trying to figure out how to say yes. So you've got a lot of scope there. So I'm going to kind of leap to, what about 5 years deeply ingrained? What can you do? Having people feel curious helps. So if you set up an exercise that's breaking the rules without talking about the rules, and they enjoy it, or they have a positive experience, or they become curious, that then starts giving you the opportunity to talk about the other way of doing it, or other ways of doing it. Because if you say to someone, you're wrong and what you're doing is wrong, the natural place is a defensive place. But if you can inspire the curiosity, if you can delight the wonder, then that'll help open and just make little cracks, and then you can start having the discussions.
I would say that Have they asked me to come and change to make their work out? I mean, if they didn't ask me, I mean, if they asked me, I think I would approach it in the same way as with things a little bit like what comes next, because it would be the same fear. They would have the same fear of going in a new direction as beginners will have. So I will try to, And I'll go back to the spirit of Mr. Johnstone and say, why not, if they ask me to do the work with them, to try to find a new path, I'll say, why don't we try to do the opposite of what you're doing? Why not just have fun and be out there on deep water? Because there's a new ocean you have to jump into. So let's help each other to find ways. And also I'll ask him, so what is it you want to do? Why do we want to change? Could you stimulate what you already have there by looking at it in new ways? I mean, I would try to find by all the means I have, I would try to make them more curious and to open up their imagination in new ways. There's a beautiful part in your book, Patty, where there's this woman in the bar, where there's a guy coming up with a pickup line, and you show there how many different ways there is to answer somebody in this. I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, I like it. So you should try to in those. Here we normally would apply this rule. What could you do instead? I mean, to just be in. Oh, I'm talking too much. I'm sorry. I'll leave it there.
For me, is to ask, if there were no rules, what would you do? The problem is when you don't know. You know, you're following a rule. You don't know you are within the system. And on my personal experience, the first big rule that I broke as a student, I had to break as a student, was to go from the specific show that we did, was Improvisation Match, the French-Canadian format, that's full of rules. But these are the rules of this format. And that's great, because this is a structure. But that's the only thing they taught us. So the first rule I had to break was what happens after the sixth minute. What's beyond minute number six? Is there a world after the sixth minute? It's like so scary. It's like, can you improvise more than 6 minutes the same story? And that for me was very scary as a student. And it wasn't offered by my teachers. I watched it. I saw somebody else doing something like that. So, there is life after the sixth minute. So what I would do is to show that now, especially now that we have access to everything, show that there are other schools, other structures, other formats, other lengths, other things. When we started improvising, there wasn't any YouTube. There were just two books, and you had to access physically to them because you couldn't download the PDF. Now we have access to everything. So the first thing is, if they want to play outside the rules, which is the first step, this is what expects you. This is what's on the other side of the sixth minute of whatever rule you set for yourself. And that immediately will trigger curiosity. The first time I watched something longer than that, it changed my mind. It changed my world. The first time I watched a long form or longer stories was like, can we do that? Yes. I went back to Buenos Aires and started trying it and failing, of course.
Fantastic.
Coming towards the end of our time, so I'm going to finish with one last question. I'm having trouble deciding because there are a lot of wonderful questions, and if we don't get to yours, I'm very sorry. But just a short one to finish on from Adam Hembry. What's one note or piece of advice that you find yourself often giving to experienced performers? So let's say 5 years plus people who've been improvising for over 5 years. You're seeing them in a scene, in a show. They come up to you afterwards and say, Do you have any notes? Can you give me any advice? You're in the bar afterwards. What do you find yourself saying to those sorts of people fairly often?
Well, anybody want to start?
It's a great question.
It is a great question. It also, like my brain is going, oh, okay.
I think it's hard to have a generic response because it doesn't mean that we all fall in the same mistakes or do the same things when we have 5 years of experience or more or less. I think by the time you were in this business for 5 years, the most honest question or feedback I could give is the question of, did you like it? Did you enjoy it? How did you feel? I think I would go that way because by that time, you should enjoy what you do and should be comfortable in the good way, in the uncomfortable way of what you just did. And you look at the face of the person that asks you for something, whether they are looking for you to say, yeah, I know it was a hard show. And when they are looking for some good, clear advice, or when they're looking for, yes, you did a great job, from reaffirmance of what they did. I think that's the clinical eye that we have.
I find it very difficult to sort of give a general answer on that. I try to look at people to see why they are asking me. In some parts of the impro world here in Denmark, I'm Papa Impro in some sense. So I have a status that is very annoying in some ways. And very often I say, if they ask me, did you like it? I will very often say, can I give you my most sincere answer? If they say yes, I say what I think. If it was boring, if they were missing points, if they didn't give me enough, or I would say, it was fantastic you were taking me on this story about this man telling his wife that blah, 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 was very exciting. You were stimulating me. But I asked them if they want me to be honest. Mm. And then if they say yes, I'll be honest. I'll say my opinion on the thing. Very, very often people get very offended. And there are people who are hating me out there because I say...
What happens when they say no? Don't be honest.
I say, thank you for this evening. I hope to see you again someday. And I mean, it's what are they asking? What are their needs? You understand? Mm-hmm. If they really are asking me professionally, I'll ask them professionally. But also, sorry, I'm talking a lot again, but here in Denmark, we don't have a tradition of discussing theory. I mean, I've been trained also in France. In France, you can have a discussion. I think this was a piece of shit you were doing there. Ba-ba-bam, ba-da-bim, ba-da-bum, all this. And then afterwards say, okay, never mind. Let's go and have a pint and you're friends. We don't have that culture here in Denmark. So in that sense, it's also depending what is the culture. Yeah, that's... Yeah,
and also this idea of if you really want to know, let's have a coffee during the week. So I can process it and you can process what just happened. Yeah. And then we can talk more professionally about what just happened. And also, depending on the trust you have with this person, if it's a good friend, you know, it's like I said, you just read their face and they read yours. And I have a very transparent face. So they know that that's the Fenya face. Run. don't ask.
But also I know after performing or after teaching, I don't want to talk to people because I need, like you said, I need time to let things sink in so I know. I mean, also, after I just finished some classes at a school yesterday, and I said to the students, just tell me what you got from it. Don't tell me anything because I know what I'm doing, more or less. And I just have time to look back at it. I don't want you to, no, I don't want comments immediately after.
A hug is always a good feedback. Because maybe you need it because you had a shitty show. Maybe you need it because you need some. Yes, you rocked. And hug always helps.
Absolutely.
If I'm working with a group and we're working on a show together, so if it's a company that I'm working with a lot, or a group I'm working with a lot, and we've set a creative objective, there's something that we're trying to do in the show, I want notes, and I love notes after a show. But that's also been very much the culture for me in my training. If I'm at a festival doing a show and you've got a group of people coming together and we had a 5-minute brief or no brief and you're learning and discovering each other, I'm still curious to learn from it. But notes right after that show is difficult because we're finding each other and the work at the same time. So they're very different experiences. To answer Adam's question, from my perspective, there are, and this is really using a big, you know, wide brushstroke here, because not everybody has everything at the same time. But improvisers do tend to go through sort of stages of learning. And in around the 3 to 5 year mark is a stage of narrative plateauing, where there's been a lot of the basic skills that have been learned and digested, and the performers can shape a scene, begin a scene, play a scene, but there's still maybe a little fearful of taking the next risk or the next leap into the unknown. They've also had enough experience now to start creating safety nets and have a little bit of performer ego. So they can be incredibly charming, but technically weak.
You can say you're talking about me. It's okay.
So Jim in particular. No. So I do find, like, if we're looking at, you know, around the 5-year mark, common feedback and notes will be about the advanced moment in the scene, or being able to look at the platform, really pay attention to the platform, advance the story. I'll ask questions like, what are you trying to say? What do you want to create? Are you creating the work that you want to create? Because often they're following a flow of what they've been told to do. And now's the time that they should be going, what do I want to do? So I try to prompt those thoughts to see if there's anything there, and to ask them to look at whatever patterns they have and to break them. So if you know you're really good at being this charming person, try playing the asshole character. If you're really good at singing, try to do more physical, like try to do the opposite of what you already know you're good at, so that you can expand your awareness and your skills and not get into building a safe identity around a way that you improvise, to keep yourself open to whatever is needed from you in the improvisation.
Absolutely. So certainly that's been my experience, is that the most powerful improvisation notes I've received are really notes about being a person, like how do you just notes about how to be in the world that are then sort of filtered through a more technical lens. That is all that we have time for, although I'm sure we could keep chatting about these things all night long, or if you're in Europe, all day long. So I would like to thank our guests. I'd like to thank Steen, Fenya, and Stephen, who had to duck off a little early and sends his apologies, but also thank you all of them for a wonderful time. Thank you, Patty, for your time, for being a guest, for connecting us with all of these wonderful people. Once again, that book that is being held up is Improvise Freely. You can get it at pattystyles.com or from your local bookshop, or from one of the Megacorp online book slingers. We'd also like to thank Reese Oteri and Pan Reed of Impro Melbourne for their help in getting this webinar up and running. And a quick announcement, this event has been put on by Impro Melbourne, Q-Slide. So you can find out more about them at impromelbourne.com.au. And, you know, an independent theatre company in a city that is predominantly locked down. So if this webinar was useful to you, we would love it if you could chip in a few dollars or cents, or dollars and cents, to help keep the lights on and keep events like these happening in the future. Thank you all so much for your wonderful questions, for your time. We look forward to the next one, which will be happening shortly. Stay tuned to our Facebook page for more details. Otherwise, have a wonderful evening and speak freely. We didn't discuss that being the sign-off, but it's going to be. So speak freely, everyone.